In this hour, we're going to bring you a special Federal Drive panel discussion. Our topic today is cybersecurity and the importance of industry-government cooperation. Today's discussion is sponsored by Level 3 Communications, and we have two special guests joining us in studio this morning. Scott Algier is Executive Director of the Information Technology Information Sharing and Analysis Center, or ITISAC, and Vice Chair of the National Council of ISACs, or NCI, and Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller joins us too. Jason has just completed a week-long series, Cybersecurity Rising. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
So let's start off by looking at what some of the government and private sector partnerships are that we're seeing. It seems like these sort of things are happening with or without a law or executive order. Scott, let's start with you. What do you see that excites you?
Sure. So there actually is already a lot of work going on between industry and government, and has been going on for about a decade now, if not longer, to secure the critical infrastructure specifically and cybersecurity more generally. So the organization I'm involved with, the ISACs, the IT ISAC, we're part of that public-private partnership where we bring together industry and government with the specific purpose of sharing information about threats to the information technology networks and systems so that we can enhance situational awareness, share some threat indicators with each other about what some of the attacks that are ongoing, and we can work collaboratively to identify mitigation strategies.
And just to clarify, within the ISAC, say for the IT ISAC, is it all vendors or is the government also part of these too? I mean, the sharing goes across that border.
Sure. So the ISAC itself is a nonprofit organization that's is owned by the member company. So we're only open to the private sector. We have a non-disclosure agreement in place that enables the sharing of information within our membership, and we have an operations center that takes some of that information and anonymizes it and shares it off with government. We also have a strong relationship working with the Department of Homeland Security, where our analysts collaborate directly with their analysts, and then the ISAC community themselves comes together on a regular basis to share information. There are 12 or 13 different ISACs that are part of the National Council of ISACs.
And Jason, so you've been covering this all week, talking about cybersecurity rising. And the background to all this, of course, is the executive order that we're waiting for from the White House and the still unpassed federal bill. But it seems like from what Scott said, there's a lot of information sharing already happening.
Well, I think that from the very beginning and whenever that is from there, there's the idea that the government can't do it alone. Industry can't do it alone. They both have certain expertise, certain types of viewpoints that if they don't come together, they're not as whole. And I think that was realized probably about 2007 time frame when the Defense Department initially kicked off the pilot called the Defense Industrial Base Pilot. This initially was just a DoD pilot where they reached out to their vendors and said, listen, you see stuff, we see stuff, let's come together and see stuff together. I mean, I think it's the idea of crowdsourcing before the term crowdsourcing came up. You know, all of us together are smarter than one of us or each of us alone. And I think that really kicked off what the information sharing has really turned and is becoming, and is really in many ways the basis for a lot of the legislation, a lot of the executive order. And the DIB pilot, which now has been moved to the Homeland Security Department, started fairly small and has kind of grown and grown and grown. And I think there's something like 1,000 companies that have some kind of role in the industrial base pilot. I'm not even sure if you can call it a pilot anymore, but it's the idea of sharing information back and forth of what they're seeing. There's a lot of issues, and we can get into them in a little bit, but I think that's really the one of the most exciting things that's happening across the government and within industry.
And just for either of you, I mean, just to sort of have a concrete idea, what when we say information sharing, what information is being shared?
Yes, so there's a variety of information that's being shared. Frequently, what we're sharing are attack indicators. These are attacking IP addresses. This is we've seen malicious traffic from these websites, and this is this is the signatures for it. We've seen new spear phishing type of emails against some of our executives, and here's the text of it. Be on the lookout for that type of stuff. But then it's also when an attack is ongoing, when an attack is taking place, it's a lot of comparison comparing notes too. Okay, what exactly are you seeing? What have you done to mitigate the attacks? What's working? Can you reroute the traffic? So the type of information sharing is really, it varies, and it's really, one of the challenges that we have in information sharing, I think, is that the government and industry often view threat differently. Industry views it from a business perspective. I have business assets I need to protect, and they manage that risk like they manage a lot of the other risks. You know, there's only so many dollars that the government, that the industry can spend, without impacting shareholder value. The government views this from a national security perspective. So their tolerance for risk, I think, is a lot less on private sector networks than sometimes it is on private sector networks.
And if you would just give us an idea of the types of companies that are in the IT ISAC. And the reason I ask is because in all of the other sectors, you know, utilities and financial, IT is the whole point because we're talking about cybersecurity. So you are the IT companies. Is it cloud providers? Is it people that make the switchgear? Who is it?
Sure. So a lot of our members are vendors. So when the ISAC was formed 10 years ago, it was a very vendor-heavy forum. But we're expanding out beyond vendors now as well. So we have our Oracle Corporation. Marian Davidson from Oracle is the president of the ISAC this year. We have Intel Corporation, CSC, and then companies such as Cargill, which is not a traditional IT company, but it uses, you know, the IT infrastructure for their supply chain and logistics.
All right.
So you mentioned one of the challenges, this lack of, a common definition between what industry says is really a cyber threat and what the government might say. But what are some of the key ingredients for success when it works well?
I think one of the key success attributes is that everyone is treated as equals. So there has to be a partnership of equals. And this requires that industry and government work, identify common issues that they want to work on, and then jointly develop a plan to address those issues. I don't think it's enough for industry to be shared documentation that says, this is our plan, you know, you have a week to give us what you think. I think we're much better served by us identifying joint priorities and then working towards those priorities together.
And I think, just let me jump in, Tom. I think one of the things that the legislation is being hung up on is this issue of whether you are told to do something or you're being a part of it. And I think that there's a big disagreement. And we can go down this path of legislation a little bit, but the idea that who's being told and how the collaboration's working, and if it's voluntary versus mandated. And I think that's what your point of both the tolerance for risk and the idea of are we doing this in a collaborative manner. I think those are the two probably biggest issues that's holding up the comprehensive legislation.
And Jason, getting back to the executive order that may or may not be coming out someday in our lifetimes, who knows when, from your perspective and following this so carefully, is the administration aware that all of this sharing goes on now through the ISACs and other means?
Absolutely. In fact, I was at a recent event maybe about 2 or 3 weeks ago where Michael Daniel, who's a cybersecurity coordinator in the White House, spoke, and he made actually a very, very big deal about this pilot program that's being done in the electricity field. It's called the Energy Department's running the electricity critical infrastructure sector. It's called the Subsector Cybersecurity Capability Maturity Model. And basically, they're taking this maturity model and they're applying it to something that was developed with the energy sector, and they're saying, okay, energy sector, use this model, look at yourself, how do you rate on this model, and then figure out if you're level one, then that's low, and you, what is your risk, and do you need to get to level two or three, and if you're level three, do you need to get to level four, and make that risk-based decision. And I think that's, in many ways, what the White House is looking at as far as the executive order, because as we know, executive order, you can't mandate anything. You can only cajole, ask, plead, beg, but you cannot, you know, say you will do this. And I think that maturity model is an example that I think the White House would be looking at in the same regards for the executive order.
Our guests today are Jason Miller, executive editor of Federal News Radio, and Scott Algier, executive director of the Information Technology, Information Sharing and Analysis Center, and vice chair of the National Council of ISACs. It's a Federal Drive discussion on cybersecurity partnerships sponsored by Level 3 Communications. It's 9:17. We'll have lots more after the short break. I'm Emily Kopp along with Tom Temin, and you're listening to Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Good morning. It's 9:20, and welcome back to our Federal News Radio Federal Drive discussion, Cybersecurity Public-Private Partnerships, sponsored by Level 3 Communications here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Tom Temin, along with Emily Kopp. And our, as I said, our topic today is federal cybersecurity and the industry-government cooperation and partnership it requires. Our guests are Scott Algier, Executive Director of the Information Technology, Information Sharing and Analysis Center, or IT-ISAC, and he's also Vice Chair of the National Council of ISACs. And Jason Miller, Executive Editor of Federal News Radio, who just completed a week-long series, Cybersecurity Rising.
So before the break, we were talking a little bit about this difference in definitions in language. So I just want to toss it out to you guys. I mean, what does a cyber risk look like? What does it mean, cyber risk?
Sure. I think industry and government view this in two different ways. Right? Industry, they have intellectual property, customer information, research and development, business plans, all of that are key ingredients for a successful business that they have a business interest in protecting. But they also have a legal obligation to maximize shareholder value. So they need to balance the investments in cybersecurity and the risk in cybersecurity with other business risks against marketing, against physical security, against the communications. So there are a lot of evaluations, the considerations that go in for industry. In contrast, the government, they have the constitutional responsibility, if you will, for providing for the common defense. And you know, what that really means is, you know, a little up in the air. However, they have an interest in securing the critical infrastructure, the key elements that propel the economy and that enable the Department of Defense and the government to function. So the perspective is different. And so they look at risks in a different manner, which results in industry and government having two different approaches.
Well, it's funny because you talk about risk from a very business perspective. And one thing I've noticed over the last year and a half or 2 years is the push the government has made toward continuous monitoring of their networks, the idea that you just can't do the Federal Information Security Management Act authorizations every 3 years, but we have to do it monthly near real time or as often as possible. Is that idea of risk? I mean, you get a lot more conversations about what is the risk to the system and can we take on that risk, or is the risk too high and we need more security? And I just was attended a recent conference where that idea of not just risk management, but of applying risk to a certain level of systems. And there may be some systems where you say, you know what, I don't have the budget and the risk is low. So therefore my cyber is going to be basic. I'm going to just check the boxes that say protect the system versus another system that may have national security information, or it may have even, you know, citizen information. They say, no, this risk of losing this information or this system is too high, so therefore I will check the box. So I think the government's actually coming toward the industry to understand, oh, well, I don't have a big budget anymore, and I got to measure that. I got to take into account what my risk is.
Because, Scott, isn't it fair to say that in industry, although they seem like they have all the money from the government perspective, they're not willing to spend unlimited money on cybersecurity, but there's also a cost-benefit analysis, and they look at it as a cost as they look at all IT as a cost.
Yes, I mean, it is definitely a cost-benefit analysis. And I think what industry has shown that it has the expertise to enlarge, for the most part, defend its networks. I mean, they repel thousands of attacks a day on their networks. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say all the industry networks are as secure as they can be, but I think the overall track record of industry of securing their networks is pretty strong. You have areas where it fails, but I think the overall history of industry for securing their networks, creating products and services to defend against these networks, I think is pretty strong.
Again, though, the definition of what a cyber threat is or what risk is does really matter, because we see leaders both in the White House and in Congress trying to put this into words, right? Trying to put it into legislation or executive order. Scott, my question for you is, among the companies that you work with closely and that you know, is there a common definition among them? Or does every company sort of have its own own approach to what a cyber threat is.
Sure. So I think there are general threat actors that that we all have in common. There are certain technologies that we all use that we all have in common. So that's another commonality. And I think when the commonality among my among the companies who I talk to about risk and risk management is identifying the most important business critical assets and prioritizing those over less critical assets. One of the other examples of measuring risk is we talk frequently about risks to the IT sector. Can the internet go down? Is there going to be an attack that will take out the internet? A couple of years ago, we led a group of industry and government experts who looked at this. We looked at specific critical functions that the IT sector provides, which goes from incident management to the DNS and routing services. And what we came up with is, you know, a large scale internet outage is likely not going to happen. So we should stop, we should not focus resources on an event like that. That is not likely to happen.
Our guests today are Scott Algier. He is executive director of the Information Technology Information Sharing and Analysis Center, ISAC, and vice chair of the National Council of ISACs, and Jason Miller, executive editor of Federal News Radio. This is a Federal Drive discussion, cybersecurity, public and private partnerships, sponsored by Level 3 Communications. We're going to have a lot more after the short break. I'm Tom Temin, along with Emily Kopp, here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
It's 9:30. Welcome back to our Federal News Radio Federal Drive discussion, sponsored by Level 3 Communications on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Emily Kopp, along with Tom Temin. Our topic today is federal cybersecurity and the industry-government cooperation and partnership it requires. Our guests are Scott Algier. He's executive director of the Information Technology Information Sharing and Analysis Center and vice chair of the National Council of ISACs. And Jason Miller, he's executive editor here at Federal News Radio and just completed a series called Cybersecurity Rising.
And just before the break, we were talking about the idea of people considering the internet coming to a halt. And of course, that's a big issue for both industry and government, but especially government. And Jason, what do they think about that in those terms?
I think that's one of the reasons why this idea of public-private partnership has grown so much, especially over the last 2-3 years. I mean, beforehand, everyone kind of understood the internet. We had it. We got online. We did stuff. But as more things moved to be e-enabled, for lack of a better word, e-government got big, e-commerce got big, the government was dependent on the private sector more and more. I think the number is like 80 or 85% of all the government's networks, traffic systems run in some commercial way. So I think somebody a number of years ago by now, but said, you know, this partnership has got to be a little stronger because of our dependence. So I think the government's hugely concerned about an internet shutdown. And I think you hear that, for instance, from Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, his speech on the Intrepid a couple weeks ago in New York City regarding what DOD is doing around cybersecurity, what DOD is doing. I mean, he made a point of saying we are sharing information. We are part of a government-wide effort that includes not just DHS, but the FBI, but the Secret Service, and Commerce Department, NIST, for instance, and on and on.
Yes. And of course, it's been decades since the government really ran its own isolated networks, maybe CIPRNet, but even NIPRNet now for many years, I think, has, you know, blended internet using virtual private networking technologies and so forth. So when they get together, then in the information sharing sense, Scott, how does that all come into play? The fact that the medium for all of this great commerce and government delivery is a common one.
Right. So the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center, the NCIC, is the primary focal point for the sharing of cyber threat information for civilian purposes. There's U.S. Cyber Command that works on DOD networks and DOD focus, but the NCIC brings together various cyber centers from the federal government, including the FBI, the Secret Service, and the Cyber Command also has representation there, along with the the DHS elements, the U.S. CERT, the ICS CERT, and private sector ISACs. So the IT ISAC, we've signed one of those creator agreements to enable us to be on the NCIC floor and be part of that information sharing process. Other ISACs, financial services specifically, I believe, have also are also embedded on the floor. So it's we're building a capability, and it's a capability that we've recognized 7-8 years ago, I forget how long it's been, that where we first called for this joint integrated in the integrated center. And so the NCIC is the beginning of that capability.
In fact, let me jump in on the NCIC because my interview with Mark Weatherford, which is a, let me just, little plug here, posted right there on federalnewsradio.com for everyone to come and see. We talk a lot about the NCIC, and that's really the hub of this information sharing activity. Let me give you one example that Mark Weatherford gave to me, and I think this is a perfect example. Recently, we heard a lot about cyber attacks, denial of service attacks against the financial services industry. What happened, the way he described it, was the financial services industry had people on the floor at the NCIC, and when they started seeing this attack, all of a sudden it wasn't just, well, let me give this piece of paper over to you, and you look at the piece of paper over to me, and then we talk later, and then, you know, 3 or 4 days later, everything is, you know, resolved. It was a real time, it was immediate, and it was whole of not just government, but the whole of community looking at it. So if there was a attack against a specific type of system, maybe someone from the IT ISAC could get involved because, oh, that's my system, let me tell you how to fix it. And then maybe someone from the, you know, law enforcement community said, yeah, we are tracing where it's coming from, and here, if you close this port, because that's what the level of technology that they know, that will help, you know, at least mollify the attack a little bit. So I think the fact is that the NCIC is playing such a big role right now.
So it sounds, in many ways, as you just described, like a win-win. But when companies decide to join it, what sort of trade-offs do they have to negotiate? What sort of things are they concerned about that they have to evaluate carefully before they decide to jump in?
Sure. So the that's really a really good question, because the NCIC is it's at the beginning of a capability that we have now. One of the challenges is that it conducts business at the TSSCI level, so not everybody has that clearance.
So real quick, top secret.
Right. I think the SCI is secure compartmental information as well. I don't have one, so I'm not exactly sure what the acronym means. But it does take some work to get a person cleared for there. For example, it took us 9 or 10 months to get our two analysts cleared to go on the NCIC floor, and they already had top secret clearances. So
that's worse than the NSA.
it's a new process. It really held us back, because it wasn't until this week that our second analyst had the proper clearance to go on the floor. The second challenge is they can see some of the classified information, and they can see what other agencies are seeing. But working to get that cleared and create a terror line so that it can be shared with industry in a useful manner, that remains a challenge.
And in fact, one of the hardest pieces is getting those cleared people on the other end. So if the NCIC sees something, is there somebody in company X who can also see that information? And then can they declassify it, for lack of a better word, to share it more broadly to say, okay, we see an attack on port 1234. We can't tell you anything else, but you need to close that port. And if the company goes, "Boy, I can't close that port," no. You need to close the port, and that trust has to be there. So if Scott tells me to close the port, I trust Scott, and Scott says, "All right, I'm going to close the port." So I think that's the other piece that's I think happening with the NCIC. What's it trying to create?
Our guests today are Jason Miller, executive editor of Federal News Radio, and Scott Algier, executive director of the Information Technology Information Sharing and Analysis Center and vice chair of the National Council of ISACs. You're listening to a Federal Drive discussion on cybersecurity public-private partnerships. It's sponsored by Level 3 Communications.
9:40, and welcome back to our Federal News Radio Federal Drive discussion, Cybersecurity Public-Private Partnership, sponsored by Level 3 Communications, here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Tom Temin, along with Emily Kopp, and our guests today are Scott Algier, Executive Director of the Information Technology, Information Sharing and Analysis Center, IT ISAC, and he's Vice Chair of the National Council of ISACs. And also Jason Miller, executive editor of Federal News Radio, fresh off completion of a week-long series, Cybersecurity Rising. And Scott, my next question for you is, within an ISAC, you share information, the industry shares information about cybersecurity threats with the corresponding federal agency. So if it's an energy ISAC, it's with FERC maybe, or the Energy Department, financial, maybe Treasury, and so forth. Within a sector, at what point, what's the threshold of a threat at which that ISAC or the agency may want to bring in Homeland Security, or I guess in some cases, conceivably, the Defense Department?
Sure. So each ISAC has their own thresholds and their own internal triggers as to when they want members to share or what type of information they want members to share. And then when that information reaches the ISAC Operations Center, when the ISAC shares it with other agencies. Generally, information that's required by regulators, companies will share that directly with the regulator without going through the ISAC. But the general role of the ISAC is to collect information that's submitted by their members, and then look at that information for commonalities and trends. And when they see those commonalities and trends, then that's when they say, oh, interesting, Sector X might be interested in that, or we have three or four IT companies, three or four banks are seeing these same type of attacks. Let's go ahead and submit that information up to the NCIC so that the government, we can give visibility of that within the government so that they can then go out and look on their networks for similar type of attacks.
And Scott, when in the example you just gave, or in general, how long does it take before, say, one particular company notices something's wrong for the NCIC or Homeland Security to also be aware of it?
Again, it depends on the reporting within the sector. So it could be, you could have a situation where one member is being attacked, and then the next day another member is being attacked, and a member company may not know to submit that information because, hey, it's just one of millions of attacks that they get. But if a member company does share it, then the ISAC will go back to the other companies and say, hey, is anyone else seeing this same type of information? In contrast, you could have two or three companies reporting the same information the same day, and then that would generally make its way out into to that sector, across the other ISACs, and into the Department of Homeland Security within that same day.
And in many ways, that's the role of something called the U.S. CERT, the U.S. Computer Emergency Response Team. They play a role in distributing the information and collecting and distributing. Because as Scott was saying, if one federal agency sees one type of attack and they just think, oh, it's just one of many, but if that same attack is being put upon 13, 15, 20 agencies, all that data that's being pushed back to U.S. CERT, your circus, okay, I see a trend here, and that trend is more dangerous now than maybe individually. I mean, again, it goes back to our beginning conversation of, for instance, the DIB pilot. All of us together are smarter than one of us alone. And I think that, in many ways, is the theme of what you are seeing from stuff like the ISACs, from like stuff like the NCIC, and definitely things like the U.S. CERT.
And, of course, you always hear from the cyber privacy, cyber civil liberties groups that they're very wary of military or national security agency involvement in these kinds of responses. But I would think, and Scott, you can tell us what you find within the industry, in the ISACs, I would think that if something's really bad happening, like you said, the serial attacks on the banking industry that have been happening over the last couple of weeks, that they might welcome that involvement. It's like bringing your big brother to the playground who also has two baseball bats.
Yeah, it's really interesting because there's a question of what can the federal government do to protect industry networks that industry isn't already doing. To what additional capabilities can a federal agency come or bring to a large multinational corporation to defend their networks? So a lot of people who I speak with tend to think that they can secure their networks better than the government, and there's actually a lot of the federal government doesn't actually have enough of those skill sets to deploy to all of the companies in America to defend those networks.
So can I push you on that? Do companies then think that perhaps they're doing the government a favor, but they're not seeing a lot back from the government?
Well, I wouldn't say that they view it as doing the government a favor, but I think the companies who I deal with understand that by sharing this information, we can, the concept, what we can do more together than we can individually. And So by sharing this information, it helps secure the infrastructure as a whole. I think one of the areas where the government can provide more value is in sharing information more timely, and helping us to identify risks that we might have in common.
I think Scott touched upon one interesting topic, that does the government have the skill set to help to come to the rescue? They're never going to have enough people, I think, and I don't think agencies are ever going to have even the skill set that many in industry will have. But let's be honest, I mean, the skill sets you have at the National Security Agency, the national skill sets that are being developed at the U.S. Cyber Command, the national skill sets, even to some extent at DHS, are going to be as good or better than what you're going to see in other places across government, I mean, across industry. And I think that's where that benefit comes in, that it's not just in industries on by themselves or working together. It's having that government perspective and the government technology. And I mean, I think the government sometimes gets a bad rap, but they're the ones who develop a lot of the cutting edge technology. Then industry kind of commercializes and broadens and makes it a lot bigger, useful. Or at least they pay for it. They may not develop it.
Our guests today are Jason Miller, Executive Editor of Federal News Radio, and Scott Algier, Executive Director of the Information Technology, Information Sharing and Analysis Center, and Vice Chair of the National Council of ISACS. You're listening to a Federal Drive discussion on cybersecurity public-private partnerships. It's sponsored by Level 3 Communications. It's 9:47. We'll have more after this break. I'm Emily Kopp, along with Tom Temin on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Here's Brian McGrath, Chief Information Officer of the Census Bureau, on the IT Innovation in the New Era of Government panel, sponsored by Unisys.
One of the strategies that we're trying to employ is really empower the vendor community to bring their best and brightest to help us solve problems. So rather than just paying them to perform a service based on an hourly rate or based on a commodity, we want to look at providing an incentive structure so that our vendors bring their best and brightest.
To listen to the whole panel made possible by Unisys, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Agility isn't about sacrificing quality to stay ahead. It's about rapidly taking advantage of disruptive technologies like cloud and mobility to drive results. Unisys leverages its global IT leadership to bring commercial best practices that help meet the challenges of government. Agencies trust Unisys to provide the expertise, technology, and value meeting today's demands for efficiency while driving innovation. Learn more at unisys.com/federal. Unisys, delivering a safer and more secure connected world. Government technology professionals should prepare to attend GovCom 2012, the trade show featuring government audiovisual communication solutions at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center, November 28th and 29th. Leading manufacturers and solutions providers will be showcasing the latest in audio-video, conferencing, collaboration, control systems, digital signage, and visual display technologies. GovCom will help you boost collaboration, enhance security, improve reliability, and cut costs. See cutting-edge communications products, get valuable training from leading experts in government and industry, and network with other professionals. Visit Government Video Expo, the leading show for government video and broadcast technology, now co-located with GovCom. For more information and your free exhibits pass, visit govcom2mshow.org and use the code FED. GovCom is brought to you by Infocom International, the Audiovisual Trade Association.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does three decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time. But the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit CapitalAreaFoodBank.org.
For 125 years, Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington has served the youth of our nation's capital and its surrounding communities. Your support will help over 21,000 youth who need you most walk through the doors of a Boys and Girls Club and walk out with a plan for their future. Every dollar donated in fiscal year 2012 will be matched up to $250,000 by Stanley Martin Homes. You can help. Go online to www.bgcgw.org and change someone's life. This message brought to you by GEICO.
9:50, and welcome back to the Federal News Radio Federal Drive discussion, cybersecurity, public-private partnerships, sponsored by Level 3 Communications, here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Tom Temin, along with Emily Kopp. Our guests today are Jason Miller, executive editor of Federal News Radio. He's just completed a week-long series, Cybersecurity Rising, and Scott Algier, executive director of the Information Technology Information Sharing and Analysis Center, and vice chair of the National Council of ISACs. And before the break, we were talking about this whole idea of where information goes, and so we should complete the circle, Scott, and when information goes into, you know, is collected by industry, we have this threat going on, we're sharing it with the government. Do we ever see it again? What happens to it?
So the NCAIC provides a forum for sharing of the information through other federal agencies. In addition to the sharing it with industry, the NCAIC provides a forum for them to share it with their federal partners. So, as Jason was talking about, the other government agencies have critical skill sets that are essential in this fight against cyberspace. But they get a lot of that information from industry. When industry shares it through the NCAIC, that information then gets distributed through those agencies. And then to bring it kind of full circle, a lot of my members, a lot of IT companies are actually contractors to those agencies, so that they then either look at the malware or help to develop some of the tools and technologies to defend against those.
Yeah, there's kind of a common ecosystem here that everybody's on the internet, everybody's using the same 8 or 9 companies' equipment for all of this and the same database vendors. You know, there's a certain set of people. They probably, when you hear a report, you probably know who it's coming from anyway, even after it's sanitized.
Yes, so our members, obviously, we see a lot. Some of the world's largest IT companies, and they have service-level agreements that they need to honor with government and private sector contracts. So it really is a team effort.
And, Jason, when we're talking about cybersecurity, where does sort of the physical security come into this?
That's actually a huge growing area and a huge growing area of concern, because I think a lot of the critical infrastructure providers, and we're not talking about, I think, Scott's companies, we are talking about energy and water and power and the financial services sector, have always been good about keeping their buildings secure. We have a fence. We have barbed wire. We have guards. We have, you know, gates.
On the other hand, you do hear a lot also about crumbling infrastructure, such as, you know, the state of those gates, et cetera.
Well, I think that you're seeing the crumbling infrastructure, the state of the water pipes. So I think that the gates are probably fairly strong. That's easy to replace. That's low cost. But I think what's happening is what DHS is trying to do, and I think this is what Mark Weatherford's, one of his main goals, is to bring the awareness and the acceptance from these critical infrastructure providers to say, hey, physical is dangerous, but so is cyber now. And in fact, a cyber intrusion could be a lot worse than a physical intrusion.
That's right, because we have seen, I think if there's an inflection point in this whole great effort in cybersecurity, it has to be pegged at Stuxnet, which showed that something outside of the standard internet can nevertheless get into an isolated system and cause physical damage. So that's really, is it physical? Is it cyber? What's the difference? It involves cyber to cause physical. And I imagine that must be coming up a lot in the ISACs.
Yes, definitely. The industrial control systems are been getting a lot of visibility recently. Obviously, Stuxnet and some son of Stuxnet type malware is out there. I've been getting a lot, and this raises one of the interesting questions about the threat. Is now that Stuxnet is out there, we're all at risk now. It elevated the capabilities of all of the actors, because the malware is out there, the code is out there. So, you know, without knowing who developed that malware, it was really sophisticated, and you no longer need to be really sophisticated to launch it, because you have it now.
It's almost like the first person to ever swear on cable television or on, you know, radio that once that breach is broken, you can never get it back right in the bottle, I guess.
I was actually thinking about the nuclear arms race, but yes, what you just said is much nicer to think about.
Swearing nuclear arms race.
Not on this station, by the way.
The one of the things that I think DHS is recognizing, they're actually doing, I think, two things to recognize this idea of cyber intrusion is just as dangerous as physical intrusion. They have something called Industrial Control Systems Computer Emergency Response Team, or Cyber Weatherford Emergency Response Team. And the way Mark Weatherford described it was he calls them flyaway teams. If there's a problem, they go. They go to the event. They provide, kind of assess the threats, vulnerabilities, and attacks, and help the critical infrastructure owner and operator recover and deal with the attack. The other thing they're doing is they have something called a PSA program, Protective Security Advisor Program. And basically he wants to extend that right now. That's really focused on the physical side. He goes, we want to add a cyber element to it because we're getting asked for help on the cyber side. So there are steps they're taking to kind of bring those two sides together.
That brings our discussion to a close, unfortunately, but we would like to thank our guests, Jason Miller, Executive Editor of Federal News Radio, and Scott Algier, Executive Director of the Information Technology, Information Sharing and Analysis Center, and Vice Chair of the National Council of those centers, the NCI. You've been listening to a Federal News Radio Federal Drive panel discussion on cybersecurity, public-private partnerships, sponsored by Level 3 Communications. You can find our extensive coverage of cybersecurity at federalnewsradio.com, and that's where we're going to post this entire discussion as well on our page, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. And coming up next, Inside Government, brought to you by American Federation of Government Employees. I'm Emily Kump.
And I'm Tom Temin. Join us Monday morning starting at 6 for the Federal Drive right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We are your source for federal news now.